talking. Reacher turned back to the guy at the table. He was pale. He had a buzz cut growing low on his forehead and old acne pits on his cheeks. His gaze was alternating between Reacher and his pal on the floor, back and forth, like a metronome, panic in his eyes. Reacher said, "I'm going to take a wild-ass guess and say you're not the brains of the operation, which leaves you in a vulnerable position. But luck is on your side. I'm a reasonable man. The one-time special offer is still open. For you only. Minimum sentence in exchange for full disclosure. I'm going to count to three. And it's gone." More panic in the guy's eyes. He opened his mouth, but he couldn't speak. Not very bright. Not very verbal. Reacher said, "Who told you to be here today?" The guy pointed at his pal on the floor. He said,
"He did."
Reacher said, "Why?"
"We sell things."
"Where?"
"In the bar."
"What kind of things?" No answer. Reacher said, "Big or small?"
"Small."
"Handguns?" The guy nodded. "Beretta M9s?" The guy nodded. Reacher said, "Anything else?"
"No."
"Okay, you sell sidearms to skinheads. Congratulations. New or used?"
"Only old ones."
"From where?"
"We take them from the scrap trucks."
Reacher nodded. "Retired U.S. Army inventory, listed as worn out or defective or destroyed, but never quite making it to the smelter. Not uncommon." He said, "Ammunition, too?" The guy said,
"Yes."
"In that same bar?" The guy said,
"Yes."
"Where did you get the phony ID?"
"Same place. In that bar. There's a German guy."
"What else happens there?"
"All kinds of deals."
"You go there a lot?" The guy looked at his pal on the floor. He nodded. He said,
"It's where we sell things."
Reacher took the police sketch from his pocket. The American. The brow, the cheekbones, the deep-set eyes, the floppy hair. He unfolded the drawing and flattened it out and reversed it on the table. He said, "Did you ever see this man in there?" The guy took a look. He said,
"Yes, I've seen him."
Chapter 15. Nagley put the phone down and mimed a thank you to the old lady and came back to the table. Reacher said, "This guy has seen our guy in the bar." Nagley said,
"How many times?"
The guy said,
"About three."
"Over how long of a period?"
"About the last few months. Sometimes he wears a hat."
"What kind of a hat?"
"A sports team, I think. The NFL, maybe. Something with a red star."
"You know his name?"
"No."
"What does he do in the bar?"
"Nothing much."
"Is he Army?"
"Last time I saw him, he had no hat and his hair was too long."
"When was that?"
"About 2 weeks ago."
"What was he doing 2 weeks ago?"
"He was at a table near a window, drinking beer by himself."
At that moment, the American was waiting to get on a city bus to head into town. He had things to do, last-minute errands to run, and a shopping list. Hamburg was a passenger port with ferries and cruise ships in and out, so travel supplies were not hard to find, and suitable clothes for a long journey. All cash purchases, all from different places. A strict timetable, but necessary. The clock was ticking. The bus arrived, and the American got on. Reacher hauled the guy up off the coffee shop floor and pushed him out to the sidewalk. Nagley took his partner. They checked Nagley's map and headed down to a pocket park. The guy Nagley had hit limped and shuffled. His nose was broken from her second knee. It didn't make him any prettier. Or uglier. They made it to the park and took two benches. Nagley and the dumb guy sat on one, and Reacher and the casualty sat on the other. They waited. The dumb guy kept very still. He seemed scared of Nagley. Maybe not so dumb. The damaged guy got slowly better. Reacher sensed him getting restless, sensed him glancing around, calculating the angles, weighing up his chances. At one point, a city bus roared slowly past, close and huge and loud, full of passengers heading into town, and Reacher sensed the guy stir, as if the noise and commotion presented an opportunity. So he put his hand on the back of the guy's neck like a friendly gesture, and he squeezed, and the guy yelped silently, and then the bus was gone. They waited. The afternoon grew late. Then a blue car drew up at the curb, a big opal sedan, a General Motors product. At the wheel was a guy in army battle dress uniform. Beside him was another. Behind both of them was a floor-to-ceiling plastic screen. A cop car. The passenger got out, short, wide, and dark. Manuel Orozco. Late of the 110th. You don't mess with the special investigators. His phrase. A good friend, he said.
I thought you were buried in a school somewhere.
Reacher said, is that what you heard?
Everyone was talking about it, man. Like you died.
The NSC got us for a secret thing. We're shaking a tree. A whole lot of extra crap is falling out. You're going to have to clean it up for us, without mentioning our involvement. You can claim them as your own, if you like. Get another medal. Start with these two. They're selling scrap M9s to skinheads in a bar.
I won't get a medal for that.
It's really about the bar. Could be the tip of an iceberg.
What happened to his nose?
Nagley. Outstanding. We need background on the bar. Apparently, all kinds of deals go down there. Write it up as a separate report, okay? And then feel free to go fishing. But not until we say. There's one particular guy we're looking at, and we don't want to scare him away. Assuming he plans to come back, anyway. Which he probably won't.
Orozco said, you got it, boss.
I'm not your boss anymore.
I'm sure you're still the boss of something.
Orozco put the two guys in the back of the car, behind the plastic screen, and he climbed in next to his driver, and Reacher and Nagley waved them away. Then they walked back to their boutique hotel, where the clerk confirmed the consulate had indeed come through, and as a result they now had two upgraded rooms, side by side on the top floor. They went to Nagley's first, where they dialed McLean, Virginia, to check in with Sinclair. At that moment, the fingerprint technician in the police garage was on the phone with Chief of Detectives Griezmann. He said he had taken an excellent print off the back of the chrome lever, clear as a bell. By shape to his practiced eye, it was a right-hand middle finger, and it was average size for a man or large for a woman. It showed no hits in any of the federal databases. Therefore, the perpetrator was almost certainly not German. The upgraded rooms had fancy console telephones, and Nagley put hers on speaker and sat on the bed. Reacher sat in a chair. In McLean, the phone was also on speaker. Reacher heard the spacey echo, and then he heard Sinclair say hello, and then Waterman, and then White. He guessed they were all in the office at the conference table in the leather chairs. Sinclair said,
"Are you getting anywhere?"
She sounded tired. Reacher said, "The German witness was a man named Klopp, and we got a good description and a good sketch, which was faxed to you. Klopp says he's seen the guy twice. Since then, we have another witness who has seen the guy three times, all in the same bar, which seems to be partly a right-wing political hangout and partly an underground marketplace. All kinds of deals, apparently."
"Will that be the location of the second rendezvous?"
"They odds say no. They could choose anywhere from Scandinavia to North Africa." White spoke up and said, "We're cross-checking lists in several different lateral ways. State has put some big computers on it. We're watching about 400 American names, which is way too many to be useful. Their recent travel destinations include about 40 countries, which is also too many to be useful." Reacher said, "It all comes down to the same old question. What is the guy selling?" No answer.
"We got a weird piece of news," Sinclair said, "from our people in Ukraine. Just routine police blotter stuff. The Kiev Police Department reported a dead Arab in an alley downtown, killed by blows to the head, probably with a carpenter's hammer, in his 20s, and wearing a pink polo shirt with an alligator on the front, which is what caught our eye. Probably nothing. Kiev police say there was a soccer match on the TV. The locals lost to Moscow. Lots of unhappy young men in the bars. An Arab on his own in a pink shirt might have been irresistible."
"Or?"
"It's stupid to base it on the shirt, but maybe he was one of them. Maybe there's a civil war going on."
"Does it change our plan?"
"No. We should assume the messenger is still on his way. We should act as if the second rendezvous is still imminent. What we need to figure out is whether you and Sergeant Nagley should stay in Hamburg or come back here."
"They won't meet in McLean, Virginia. That's a certainty. Whereas they might meet in Hamburg again. That's at least a possibility. A small chance, maybe, but slim is better than none, surely."
Sinclair was quiet for a long moment, nothing on the line except echo and static. Then she said,
"Okay, but stay away from the safe house."
"Even if that means missing the rendezvous?"
"We'll cross that bridge when we come to it. You need to be clear on this. It's not your decision."
In Jalalabad, dinner had been eaten and the plates had been cleared away. The men in the white robes were back in their small, hot room. Half of their conversation was made up of cautious ritual reminders that nothing had yet been achieved. Not definitively. Not for sure. They were close, but not certain. Ancient proverbs were quoted, old tribal incantations along the lines of not counting chickens until eggs were hatched. But the other half of their conversation was all about counting those chickens. They counted them over and over again. Glorious, dreamy speculation. They made lists and revised them endlessly, smiling and rocking on their cushions. It was as close to erotic as those guys got. They had to choose 10 cities. They agreed Washington, D.C., New York, and London had to be included. They were non-negotiable. Which left 7 more. Paris could be the 4th, then Brussels, because of NATO headquarters and the European Parliament, and Berlin, because why not? Which left 4. Moscow might be important to their brothers in the eastern part of Europe, and Tel Aviv, obviously, although really that was a separate argument, which left 2. Amsterdam? Chicago? Los Angeles? Madrid? Then they reminded themselves once again not to count their chickens. That resolution lasted less than a minute. They rocked in silence, and then they started over with the fourth spot. Should San Francisco go ahead of Paris? The Golden Gate Bridge? The American got out in the heart of the downtown shopping district. He had a small smile on his face. The bus had slowed to take a corner near a pocket park, and out the window across the aisle he had glimpsed two guys he had done business with in the bar. They were sitting on benches. Small world. They were with two friends, a man and a woman. The man had been wearing the exact same jean jacket as him. An even smaller world. What were the odds? He crossed a cobblestone plaza and stopped at a foreign exchange booth. He swapped a fistful of Deutschmarks and dollars for Argentinian pesos. Then he did the same thing at another booth a street away, and then another. Always used and crumpled bills of mixed denominations. Always cash for cash. No huge amounts, nothing memorable, no records. He changed his final wad up at the train station, which was a sad place now. There were homeless people and disturbed people hanging around. There were furtive men with swivel eyes, their hands thrust deep in capacious pockets. There was spray can graffiti on the walls. Nothing compared to the South Bronx or inner city Detroit or South Central L.A., but unusual for Germany. Reunification had been a strain, economically and socially, and mentally. He had watched it. Like living a comfortable life in a nice little house with your family, and then a whole bunch of relatives moves in, from some place where they don't really know how to use a knife and fork. Ignorant and stunted people. But German, like you, as if a brother had been taken away at birth and locked in a closet. Then, in his mid-40s, he comes stumbling out again, pale and hunched and blinking. A tough situation to manage. He measured his pesos between finger and thumb and was satisfied. They were for incidental expenditures only, nothing more. The banker would do the heavy lifting, as arranged, by wire or telex, or whatever other secret way they did it. The cash was for tips and taxis and porters at the airport. That was all. Next, clothes, and then a pharmacy, and then a hardware store, and a camping store, and a toy store. Reacher and Nagley went out for an early dinner. They had seen plenty of spots in the neighborhood. They chose a meat and potatoes place down three steps in a semi-basement. It had brown wood paneling and accordion music on ceiling loudspeakers. Nagley said,
"Marion Sinclair is going to fly over here."
Reacher said, "Why would she?"
"I think she bought your argument about slim being better than none."
"It shouldn't need selling."
"And she wants to keep an eye on you."
"She knew what she was getting. I'm sure Garber told her."
$10, she'll be here tomorrow."
"You good for it?"
"I won't need to be. And don't give me government money. Make sure it's your own."
"She won't come," Reacher said. "It would be like backing a horse. Those people don't do that."
Then the lights seemed to dim as Chief of Detectives Griezmann walked up to their table. 6'6" and 300 pounds, billowing gray suit the size of a pup tent. The floor creaked. Griezmann said,
"I am very sorry to interrupt."
Reacher said, "You hungry?"
Griezmann paused a beat and said, "Yes, a little, actually."
Lucky guess, Reacher thought. He said, "Then please join us. Be the Pentagon's guest."
"No, I couldn't allow that. Not in my own city."
"You must be my guests."
"Okay," Reacher said.
Thank you very much. The United States Treasury is grateful. Griezmann sat down. A waiter hustled over with a third cover. Water was poured and bread was brought. Griezmann said,
I want to ask for a favor.
Reacher said, first tell us how you found us here.
Your hotel told us where you're staying. They're required to. Any booking by an embassy or a consulate or a diplomatic mission has potential security implications. So there's a system now. Then I put men in parked cars with radios. They passed you from one to the other until you came in here. I didn't want them to try following you on foot. I thought you'd spot them.
Have we done something wrong?
I need to ask for an important favor. Personally, face to face.
What kind of an important favor?
We found a fingerprint in the dead prostitute's car, remember? Exactly where you said we would. On the back of the chrome lever, a middle finger from a right hand.
Congratulations.
It has no matches anywhere in our databases.
Is that usual?
It is, if the print is foreign.
Reacher said nothing. Griezmann said,
Will you run it through your systems for me?
That's huge, Nagley said. Reacher nodded. That's political. That's a can of worms. Probably involves all kinds of NATO crap as well as the Fourth Amendment. We're knee-deep in PR people and lawyers. It would take them a year to even think about it. Griezmann sighed and said,
That's always my problem. I'm not political. I am just a simple detective hoping for a favor from one to another.
Bullshit, Reacher said. You're paying for dinner tonight because I said the word Pentagon. Maybe you'll run for mayor one day. This is a liberal city in Western Europe. The voters wouldn't like to hear the uncouth warmongers bought you a meal. So you'll have an expenses fight tomorrow instead of an embarrassment 10 years from now. I would call that fairly political on a scale of 1 to 10.
I'm just trying to catch a bad guy.
Why would he be an American?
Statistics? Crime figures?
And you think we'd admit that out loud? As in, you've got a dead hooker, so sure, it makes total sense to round up the Americans. We can't just meekly accept a presumption of guilt. Wouldn't play well at home. This stuff is way above my pay grade.
Personally, I agree with you. I think it was a sailor, one of 100 nationalities. But you're a large foreign group in Germany. I could eliminate a large number of possibilities.
So now you think it wasn't an American?
I would like to prove that, yes. An attempt will be expected of me before the case goes cold, which is what I want, frankly, as soon as possible.
Why?
Well, for one thing, we're wasting too much time on it.
Because she was a prostitute?
Ultimately, I suppose. But only through bitter experience and data. Most prostitute murders are committed by itinerants. That's a fact. This guy is already halfway across the Atlantic, I'm sure. Happy that he got away with it.
Political. Reacher felt played. He said, I'll think about it. Have a copy of the print sent to the hotel, just in case.
Don't need to,
Griezmann said. He took a small envelope from his inside pocket.
There's a copy on film in here, and a card with my number.
Reacher took the envelope and put it in his own pocket. After dinner, they elected to walk back to their hotel, so Griezmann drove away in his department Mercedes without them. They detoured via the safe house. Just an evening stroll. Just a corner-of-the-eye glance as they passed. Not that they knew which apartment. There were 15 windows plausibly related to the lobby in question. Some of them were dark. Some showed the blue glow of television. Some had low, warm light. No people were visible. There were cars on the street and occasional pedestrians. Early evening in the city. They walked on. There was a blue car parked at the curb outside their hotel, an Opel sedan. Manuel Orozco's cop car. He was waiting for them in the lobby. He said, "There's something you need to know." Chapter 16. They went back outside and leaned on Orozco's car. The evening was cool and damp. They could sense the water nearby. Reacher said,
"You could have called."
"No," Orozco said. "This is better done face-to-face than on the telephone."
"Why?"
"You gave me this small story. You missed the big story."
"Are they selling something worse?"
"No, about 40 scrap M9s over 6 months or so is all it was, plus 1,000 rounds of ammunition. Not the end of the world. We've all seen worse."
"So what's the big story?"
"Their ID was genuine."
"They're real German citizens?"
"No, they're American as apple pie. Arkansas and Kentucky. They barely speak English, let alone German. Their names are Billy Bob and Jimmy Lee, or something like that."
"So their ID was phony?"
"In that sense, yes, but it was also genuine. In the sense that it was way too good to be faked. So good, we think it must have been manufactured for them by the German government itself, in their regular plant, alongside all their regular kraut stuff."
"They said they got it from a guy in the bar."
"They said that to me, too."
"And?"
I believe them."
"So?
Where did the guy in the bar get it from?"
"How sure are you about this?"
"I asked around. We had a debate. Some say it's complicated because when the wall came down, a whole bunch of communist forgers lost their jobs. And they were really good. All kinds of mischievous documents came out of the old East Germany. So now those guys are working for someone else. Best case, that would be organized crime. Worst case, it's the new German intelligence service. Either way, best to keep this off the phone lines. We don't know who's listening."
"German intelligence can afford its own sidearms. They wouldn't need to print up phony IDs for a couple of small-time crooks."
"Agreed. But let's assume their intelligence service has a document creation division, like they all do, staffed by the usual array of eccentrics, like they all are. Suppose one of them is bent. Suppose he does his business in that bar. Billy Bob and Jimmy Lee make that place sound like the stock exchange. Buy, sell, trade, anything you want."
Reacher said, "The first witnesses saw our guy as a government worker. I guess there could be others in there."
Orozco nodded. "You need to take care. You keep on shaking that tree, all kinds of crap could fall out. Some of it could be heavy duty."
Orozco left, and Reacher stopped by Negley's room to call White in Virginia. He said, "We're getting solid intelligence that genuine German ID is for sale in that bar. So far, we've seen identity cards and driver's licenses. Nothing to say you can't get passports, too. Nothing to say our guy didn't buy one.
So watching 400 American names is a waste of time. A buck gets 10, he'll travel under a German alias. White was quiet for a long moment. Then he said,
"You're right there in town. You could find out who sold what to him, and you could find out what name he put on it. Date of birth and passport number would be good, too. These types of vendors keep records, usually, for security and blackmail."
"That's all or nothing," Reacher said. "They'll panic if we hit that bar. Word will get around fast. Our guy will go to ground immediately, and maybe he has more than one passport. There's more than one bar. Our witness splits his time between two of them. It's still our best chance. Dr. Radcliffe, I would want to know how on my own I am."
Then Reacher went next door to his room and went to bed. He was tired. He had been awake more than 30 hours. He put his shoes side by side under the window, with his socks draped over them. He folded his pants, seam to seam, and laid them flat under his mattress to press. He took off his jacket and hitched it straight on the back of a chair. A pocket crackled. Griezmann's envelope. The fingerprint. He had thought about giving it to Orozco, but he had forgotten. Next time, maybe. He took a shower and cleared a dozen green brocade pillows from his bed, and then he climbed in and went to sleep. The American's bedtime routine had not changed in several days. He started with 10 minutes of pleasure, and then he did 20 minutes of work. The pleasure came from a map of Argentina. Large scale, fine lines, a lot of detail. The ranch he was going to buy was right in the middle. It was a huge, square parcel, fully 30 miles on a side. An hour's drive at city speed limits from corner to corner. A total of 900 square miles, nearly 600,000 acres. Practically visible from outer space, but not truthfully bigger than Rhode Island, which was about 1,200 square miles. But it was bigger than the largest single contiguous property in Texas, which was only 800 square miles. Both were dwarfed by the Anna Creek Sheep Station in Australia, which was more than 9,000 square miles. Nearly 6 million acres, about the size of Massachusetts. He had read a story about its owner. The guy had put 100,000 miles on his truck without ever once leaving his own property. But still, the new place in Argentina would be in the top 10 in the world. It was a big-ass spread. No doubt about that. His house would be 15 miles behind his own fences, which was the kind of isolation he would need in the new world he was helping to create. He folded his map and started his 20 minutes of work, which was all about improving his Spanish by listening to language tapes. He was going to need workers, and he couldn't expect them to learn English. So he lay in bed with foam headphones clamped to his ears, listening, repeating, learning, until his brain got tired and he fell asleep. Nagley knocked on Reacher's door at 8 o'clock the next morning. He was awake. He had showered and dressed. He was ready for coffee. The elevator was like a gilded birdcage on a chain, inside a shaft made of filigreed wrought iron. They heard it coming up to meet them. They stepped in. There was a credit card on the floor. Or a driver's license, or something. Face down. Dropped by accident, presumably. Not the Bundesrepublik Deutschland identity card. Wrong color. Nagley bent down and picked it up. She looked at it. She said,
"You owe me $10.
It was American ID, a Virginia driver's license. The photo was sharp. A woman. An open, honest face, blonde hair, medium length, and unaffected style, no doubt combed with her fingers. Marion Sinclair. She was 44 years old, and her home address was Alexandria, a suburban house, judging by the street number. Reacher pulled cash from his pocket. He separated two American fives and handed them over. He said, "She must have just checked in after the night flight. I'm losing my touch. I didn't think she would come. And I especially didn't think she was the type of person who would lose her driver's license in an elevator. She's number two at the NSC, for God's sake. The future of the world depends on her." The elevator arrived at the ground floor. They stepped out. Breakfast was in the basement. They followed a winding stair and came out in a pretty room with double glass doors standing open, with a sunken courtyard beyond. Sinclair was right there, at an outdoor table in the morning sun, drinking coffee, eating a pastry, wearing a black dress. They walked over and said good morning. Sinclair looked up. She said, "To you, too. Please join me." They sat down, and Reacher asked her, "Why are you here?" She looked straight at him and said, "Slim is better than none."
"You dropped your driver's license in the elevator."
"Did I?" He handed it over. She put it on the table next to her cup. She said, "Thank you. Very careless of me. Very lucky you found it. I'm not using my real name here. They wouldn't have known who to return it to. You just saved me a bunch of DMV paperwork."
"Why aren't you using your real name?"
"Hotels report to the police. My name would trigger a diplomatic alert, and I'm not here, officially."
"You have an alternate identity?"
"Several. We have a document creation division, just like the Germans. I spoke to Major Orozco this morning and got the whole story. Naturally, we were watching your friends. You disobeyed me. I told you only me, Mr. Ratcliffe, or the President." "It was private business." "No business is private. Not in this matter. But please don't blame your friend for ratting you out. He had no choice. And don't feel too bad, either, because both Mr. White and Special Agent Waterman have already done the same kind of thing with their friends. Not unexpected. We were briefed about your backgrounds."
"It wasn't relevant."
"It was, because of the ID. That changes everything. ID for sale good enough to get through multiple foreign borders is very rare. We didn't include it as a factor. Now we must, which reduces our chances to less than zero. Our American will be one of 10 million anonymous people going to one of 10,000 different places."
"Our chances are better than zero," Reacher said. "He'll want a place where he feels at home and the messenger doesn't, which means a big Western city with direct connections by air. He won't want to travel more than he has to, and he's already familiar with Hamburg. He might come back. Our chances are 1 in 10, maybe."
"You're pushing to watch the safe house."
"I think we need to."
"They might have more than one."
Reacher nodded. "They might have 10 in every town on Earth. It's a percentage game. We have to start somewhere."
Sinclair nodded in turn. "We're taking it under consideration. In either case, we'll be alerted as soon as the messenger arrives, if he ever does. Then we'll take it from there. Last time, the wait before the rendezvous was 48 hours. We'll have time for a decision."
"How does the Iranian communicate?"
"On the phone, if he can, if it's safe, or by dead drop. And the Hamburg head of station just arranged a very basic early warning. Under the circumstances, we felt it was necessary. If the Iranian can't get to the phone or arrange a drop, he'll move a lamp on his bedroom windowsill, from the edge to the center, as soon as the messenger shows up. His bedroom is in the back of the building, and the window is visible from the next street over. The head of station is doing 4 drive-bys a day. A waitress with yellow pigtails came by for the newcomers' orders. Sinclair dug in her bag and came out with a large brown envelope. She gave it to Nagley and said, "This is your mail from the Department of the Army." Nagley said, "Thank you, ma'am," and opened the envelope. She checked the contents, put them back, and smiled an only the Army kind of a smile. Reacher said, "What?"
"Nothing." Sinclair said, "You can speak freely in front of me, Sergeant. I have a security clearance." "No, ma'am, it's really nothing. Not relevant at all. Except I guess it proves once again the most efficient unit in uniform is the press room. I asked for information about a 4-month-old AWOL case we found. A purely tangential inquiry. Nothing to do with anything. But Major Reacher asked me to keep him up to date with it." "Why?"
Reacher said, "That's a command I want to avoid."
"And the press room responded?"
Nagley said,
"They sent 2 generic newspaper articles about the guy's unit, the best they could do, trying to be helpful. In fact, one of them isn't even an article at all. It's an advertisement, because obviously they don't know anything about the guy himself, because they're only the press room. But they're very willing and very fast."
"And nothing from the units that do know something about the guy?"
"Not yet."
"Is 4 months unusual?"
"It would be in a unit I worked for."
Reacher said, "They're putting people in advertisements now." Nagley took out the envelope's contents for the second time, an old Army Times and a trade show handbill. The Times had a bland piece about the ongoing drawdown out of the Fulda Gap near Frankfurt, where once upon a time great swirling tank battles had been envisaged. Now the enemy was gone, and the border had moved hundreds of miles farther east, like an ebb tide, and frontline units had been stranded like fish on a beach. Some had pushed onward, just in case, and others had streamed back to immense storage lagers where they were mothballed. Just 5 chaparral units were still on active duty, including the AWOL's crew, who were featured in a photograph at the top of the story. The photograph was a posed picture, with the camera set low behind the men and their vehicle, all of which were facing away toward an imagined incoming threat. The missiles on the truck were in their launchers, aimed at a low horizon ahead, and the guys were staring at the same spot in the sky, some with binoculars, some with hands shading their eyes as if the sun was coming up, as if the viewer of the photograph was cowering 20 yards behind their manly and vigilant protection. From the rear, the men looked like a useful bunch, lean and purposeful and energetic. Reacher knew people from similar units. In his experience, they acted halfway between regular artillerymen and the flight deck crews on a Navy carrier, all hustle and bustle, with a little maverick Top Gun aviator mixed in. They thought of their trucks as parked airplanes. Morale and unit cohesion tended to be high. These particular guys all had mohawk hairstyles, with 2-inch-wide tufts running front to back across otherwise shaved skulls, all spiked up with soap or wax. Not strictly legal, according to Army Regulation 670-3-2, which said that haircuts should be neat and conservative, and that extreme, eccentric, or faddish styles were not authorized. But clearly, a wise commander had turned a blind eye. Some battles were not worth fighting, especially when more important battles were on the horizon, literally. The trade show handbill had been printed up to look like a newspaper article by a uniform manufacturer touting a new urban camouflage pattern, aimed at the Department of Defense, possibly, or at police SWAT teams. The main picture looked like it had been shot in a giant indoor studio, and it featured the same Chaparral crew as the Army Times piece and their vehicle, all of them decked out the same way, men and machine alike, in a design that looked like digital noise, made up of tiny printed rectangles, all different shades of gray. The men's faces and hands and part bald heads were painted the same way, as was the truck, and as were the missiles themselves. They were all posed in front of an artificial painted backdrop, like a theater set that showed a ruined cityscape. This time, the camera was set high and in front of them, like an incoming pilot's eye view, like an attack helicopter coming in low and close for a preemptive strike, in which case the new camouflage was doing an excellent job. The men and their machine were barely visible. They merged into the background more or less perfectly. They were a ghostly presence, both there and not there, all at the same time. No details were clear. Even the missiles themselves were hard to make out. Only the Mohawk hairstyles were obvious, five in a line, because they were the only things not painted. Very impressive, except the manufacturer had the luxury of designing the studio floor and the theater backdrop itself any old way it wanted, which in this case had been to match the camouflage exactly, which helped. The real world might be different. Sinclair put a fingernail on the ghostly, half-hidden missiles and asked, "Could things like these be stolen and sold?" "Not for $100 million," Nagley said. "That's the problem. We've been over and over it. It's a catch-22. There's no middle ground. Everything is devalued now. There's too much cheap old stuff coming out of Russia and China, and too much cheap new stuff for sale anyway. Arms manufacturers have been hustling ever since the wall came down. They're worried. They're feeling the pinch. Every month there's an arms fair somewhere. If you've got the right kind of checkbook, you can get anything you want, except nuclear, which kind of proves my point. There's no middle ground. To get to $100 million, you would have to go nuclear."
"Don't say that word out loud."
"We have to, ma'am, if only to dismiss it instantly. We have bombs on air bases back home, and missiles in silos in the Badlands, and missiles on submarines under the sea. All of them are under heavy guard, and we'd notice if one went missing. The smallest and most accessible portable piece in our current inventory is probably a Minuteman ICBM, and selling and delivering the Brooklyn Bridge would be 1,000 times easier. Plus, no individual ever knows the complete arming codes. Regulations mandate that arming codes must always be split between two personnel. That's a basic nuclear safeguard."
"So in your opinion, this is not military?"
"Unless it's intelligence."
"What kind of intelligence is worth $100 million?
"We don't know that either.
Should we audit our physical inventory?"
"That would take forever, and I can tell you exactly what it would find. We have 1 million small things missing, but no big things."
"How do you know?" "I would have heard."
"The world's most efficient grapevine," Reacher said. "Someone just told me that."
The table went quiet. Reacher said, "We should watch the safe house."
"We'd need a clandestine team," Sinclair said. "We don't have one in Hamburg, and it would be hard to justify bringing one in. Taking 1 in 10 chances is not a policy stance."
"Neither is running around with your hair on fire."
"Griezmann could do it for us," Nagley said. "His guys were pretty good. They tracked us to the restaurant last night, and he owes us. He told Stuttgart about us."
Reacher took the sketch out of his pocket, the American, the brow, the cheekbones, the deep-set eyes, the floppy hair. Recognizable.
Griezmann's guys could watch for him from strategically parked cars with radios day after day. They might be successful. He said, it would be a very big commitment, a lot of hours. We'd have to trade favors. Sinclair said,
what could we offer him?
A prostitute got strangled. He has a fingerprint. He wants us to run it through our systems.
We can't do that.
What I told them.
Anything else?
Not that I can think of. Food, possibly. There's a lot of him.
The table went quiet again. Sinclair bent down and dug around in her pocketbook and came out with her purse. It was a fat leather thing, blue in color, fastened with a tab and a popper. She scooped up her driver's license from the table next to her cup, and she unsnapped her purse and made ready to slide the license into its customary slot. Then she stopped. She said,
I have my license. It's right here.
She pincered her fingertips and pulled it out from behind a plastic window. Two licenses, side by side, everything the same. The Commonwealth of Virginia, the number, the name, the address, the date of birth, the signature, even the photograph was the same. Two licenses, identical. Chapter 17. The back part of Reacher's brain checked doors and windows, and the front part checked facts and logic. Facts and logic won. But certainty was a dangerous illusion, so he said, maybe we should go inside. Nagley went first. Sinclair grabbed her pocketbook in one hand and her purse and her two licenses in the other and hustled after her. Reacher brought up the rear. They stepped through the double doors and walked through the breakfast room and up the stairs to the lobby. No one there. Sinclair said,
we should check my room.
Reacher asked, where is it?
Top floor.
The elevator shaft was empty. The birdcage was on an upper story. Reacher said, wait one. He stepped over to the desk. The clerk who had checked them in was on duty. She was a stout old matron, and no doubt very competent. He asked her, ma'am, did a woman who resembles my friend here ask for a key? Did she show you ID? The clerk said,
resembles?
Looks like?
No, the woman said. No one asked. No one came in. There was no woman. Just a man. He waited by the elevator, possibly meeting a guest. But then I had to go into the office. I didn't see him again.
She pointed behind her at an office door. Reacher said, what did the man look like?
He was small. He was wearing a raincoat.
Thank you, Reacher said. He stepped back to the others. He said, let's take the stairs.
Nagley led the way, staying close to the wall, craning her neck, looking upward. The stairs wrapped around the elevator shaft. They could see into it through the filigreed wrought iron. Nothing was moving, just chains and cables and an iron slab of a counterweight, all immobile. They made it to the second floor, then the third. They looked up and saw the underside of the elevator car, the birdcage. It was waiting on the floor above, the top floor. Reacher said,
if it moves, we'll race it back to the bottom. We'll get there first. It's pretty slow.
But it didn't move. It just sat there. They walked up to where they could see into it. It was empty, gate closed, waiting. They came around behind it, then alongside it, climbing all the way, and then finally they stepped out into the top floor hallway. Empty. Sinclair pointed, third room along, next to Reacher's own. Upgraded, only the best for the United States government. The door was closed. Nagley said,
I'll go.
She moved silently over the thick corridor carpet. The hinge side of the door was closest, and the knob side farthest. She ducked under the peephole's field of view and flattened against the wall beyond the door. She reached out and tried the knob, backhand. Long training, always safer. Guns can shoot through doors. She mouthed, "Locked," and mimed that she needed a key. Sinclair tucked her purse and her licenses up under her arm and scrabbled in her bag. She came out with a brass key on a pewter fob. Reacher took it from her and tossed it to Nagley, who caught it one-handed and put it in the lock from the same position, backhand again, at a distance, out of the line of fire. She turned the key. The door sagged open an inch. Silence. No reaction. Reacher stepped up and flattened against the wall on the hinge side, symmetrical with Nagley, equally safe, and he spread his fingers and pushed the door wide. No reaction. Nagley pivoted around the jamb and ducked inside. Reacher followed. Long training. Smallest first, biggest last. That way, both parties got an unobstructed view, and the bigger party didn't get accidentally shot in the back. There was no one in the room. Just a wide bed with a dozen green brocade pillows and a lone wheeled suitcase with a lock in the middle of the floor. No one in the bathroom. No one in the closet. Sinclair came in and dumped her stuff on the bed. Her pocketbook, her purse, the two driver's licenses. They spilled and fluttered. Reacher closed and locked the door. He checked the window. Nothing to see. Safe enough. Sinclair said she knew her real license by a long-forgotten smudge of ballpoint ink in one corner. From cashing a check in a D.C. bank, she said, where she needed I.D., and where the writing ledge was cramped and narrow due to the thickness of the teller's bulletproof window. The exuberant underline beneath her signature had swerved off the check and touched her license. She had rubbed the mark with her thumb, removing some of it and spreading the rest. She put her real license back in her purse, and she put her purse back in her pocketbook. She left the fake license on the bed and sat down next to it. She trapped it under her fingernail, as if it might float away. She said,
"I guess this raises a large number of questions."
"One, at least," Reacher said.
"Only one."
"Have you ever mislaid your license before?"
"Is this the question?"
"Yes."
"No, never."
"Then I would say Mr. Ratcliffe has work to do."
"Why him?"
"Because they won't want to give it to the FBI. Too high a risk of a scandal."
"Who won't?"
"The White House."
"Forget the White House. Someone is running around Hamburg pretending to be me."
"Or vice versa."
"What does that mean?"
"You might be a foreign spy," Reacher said. "Maybe it's the real Marion Sinclair who's running around Hamburg."
"Are you kidding?"
"No stone unturned."
"That's ridiculous."
"You follow baseball?"
"What?"
"Baseball," Reacher said. "Do you follow it?"
"Socially, I suppose."
"Where do you go?"
"The Orioles."
"What do you see beyond the right field wall?" Sinclair said.
"A warehouse."
"Okay. You passed the test."
"Were you serious?"
"No, I was pulling your leg. Obviously, you're real because you brought Nagley's mail."
"There's a time and a place, Major."
"These are as good as any. We could get depressed otherwise."
"The White House didn't forge a copy of my driver's license."
"I agree.
We're a stone's throw from a bar where this stuff is for sale."
"Coincidence," Reacher said.
"I don't believe in coincidence."
Neither should you. Sometimes we have to. If that license had been made here in Germany, however good these people are, they would have been forced to use a press photograph from a newspaper or a magazine, reshot on regular film to make